Hello and welcome to Talking About Tumors with Ryan and Ryan. Just Ryan today, and just here to do a short little discussion on ampullary carcinoma. It's been an incredibly busy past month for us here, and we are finishing up on putting together discussions around both localized and metastatic bladder carcinoma. However, I was recently reviewing the topic of ampullary cancer for my clinic. I thought it'd be somewhat interesting, at least warranting a review of the topic. So ampullary carcinomas and periampullary carcinomas are tumors that arise near or within the ampullary evader. These are rare cancers, making up only 0.2% of all GI-based malignancies, but are clinically significant because, as you know, the ampullary evader is where the small bowel, biliary tract, and pancreatic duct all intersect. The clinical relevance of this is that it can be very difficult to determine where the origin of a tumor that arises in this area came from. As a result, many clinical trials have excluded this region, and due to its rarity, even when trials do include this within its population, such as the ABC2 trial in cholangiocarcinoma, these patients only make up a small minority of the population, and we are left to still limit our conclusions. In the past 10 years or so, we've gotten a better understanding of these, and it's more likely that tumors arising of here from this region are not all under one umbrella, but likely represent one of these three origins that are in the area. And with advancing immunohistochemistry, guidelines have been able to further specify which patients should be treated in which way. However, this all still is a bit conjecture-based, not based upon high-quality data. Depending on whether this is a pancreatic, biliary, or small bowel origin, genetic syndromes that predispose to any of those primary malignancies are just as likely to predispose to an ampullary tumor. These may arise originally as an adenoma that can then become malignant. Adenomas can still be clinically significant, as obstruction in the region can lead to biliary obstruction, risk of cholangitis, and require major surgeries, but I won't discuss those here as they're less likely to fall into the medical oncology world. Ampullary carcinomas will often present in the same way, with an obstructive-like process, and the approach to these often begins with endoscopic evaluation in ERCP and potentially stent placement to alleviate the obstruction. Once a biopsy returns showing evidence of ampullary carcinoma, staging workup should include a CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, close evaluation of the liver for any suspicious lesions with or without an MRI, and, should the disease be localized, involvement of a surgical oncologist. Tumor markers such as CA19-9 can be variably elevated in these patients. Historical rates of 5-year survival are in general poor, with ranging from 35 to 50%, not out of the ordinary for a biliary tract cancer or early stage pancreatic cancer. More recently, some investigations looking at the immunohistochemistry, as I've mentioned, have better differentiated between various subtypes, and this has been validated with a couple studies now. But prognosis can be significantly different depending on the subtype that the tumor matches. The two major distinguishing factors right now endorsed within the NCCN guidelines are intestinal or pancreatobiliary. Evaluations of long-term outcomes in these patients are significantly different, but depending on the subtype that they meet, with intestinal subtype having a median overall survival of 100 months, with pancreatobiliary having a median overall survival of approximately 15 to 20 months. The immunohistochemistry that seems to be most significant here is CDX2, CK20, and if available, MUC1 and MUC2. Many locations will have MUC1 or MUC2 as send-out labs and may not be readily available by your pathologist. The intestinal subtype tends to be positive for CDX2, positive for CK20, negative for MUC1, and positive for MUC2. The negative MUC1 can be variable in the intestinal subtype. Within the pancreatobiliary subtype, these are typically CDX2 negative, MUC1 positive, MUC2 negative, and the CK20 can be variable. So if you don't have access to MUC testing, the best distinguishing factors can be whether or not CDX2 positive, such as an intestinal type, or CDX2 negative and pancreatobiliary subtype. These markers add to the overall pathologic assessment and expert consensus, along with other clues such as nearby normal tissue or whether or not the tumor is arising from an adenoma where the appearance of the tissue may more closely resemble the region of origin. For localized disease, surgical resection is the optimal approach. This is typically done with extensive resection, such as a Whipple procedure. Although we've been moving towards a neoadjuvant approach in pancreatic cancers, this has not yet become a standard of care for ampullary tract cancers. And I think it's a hard recommendation to justify, as if we're going to be doing a Whipple regardless, and these tumors are relatively easier to achieve a complete resection versus a pancreatic cancer, then often this will be the best upfront approach. These cancers do appear to have some sensitivity to both radiation and chemotherapy, so it's feasible that there could be a role for neoadjuvant approach, but this does not seem to be the standard, and at least within the NCCN report published in 2023, less than 5% of cancers diagnosed within the United States are being treated neoadjuvantly. Broadly, adjuvant systemic therapy is recommended for these patients. However, the best approach to this is an area of debate. Early studies on ampullary cancers did incorporate radiation and were observational in nature. There was a randomized controlled trial with a significant population of ampullary patients, the EORTC 40891 trial. This was published in 2007 and used a radiation approach that probably wouldn't be considered standard now, which was giving 2 weeks of radiation with a 2 week break followed by another 2 weeks of radiation. During each radiation component, 5-FU continuous was given. This is a fairly toxic way of giving radiation, and many of the patients in that second go around of radiation had to have their 5-FU discontinued. And this trial was negative for overall survival, with a hazard ratio of 0.9, median overall survival of being 1.6 versus 1.8 years. And when isolating the periampullary patients away from the patients who are pancreatic, who were the other subgroup in this study, the periampullary patients had a hazard ratio of 1.03. A later adjuvant study, the SPAC-3 trial, which we've previously discussed when we were talking about pancreatic adenocarcinoma as being a positive trial for overall survival in the adjuvant setting, also included ampullary patients. And in this study, 297 of the patients had ampullary cancers, which is quite a large population. And this study had actually three arms, so in patients with completely resected pancreatic or ampullary cancers were randomized either to observation, 5-FU, or gemcitabine, so monotherapy for chemotherapy. When looking at the gemcitabine group, the median overall survival was improved from 40 months in the observation group to 70 months with gemcitabine, and the 5-FU had a 57.8-month overall survival. In retrospect, the overall survival for gemcitabine in this group was quite substantial and was longer than the median overall survival in the later adjuvant FOLFIRINOX trial. But regardless, there was certainly a statistical significant benefit for the ampullary patients as well as the trial as a whole. Both of these studies predated the considerations of different subtypes, so it's hard to know which patients are most likely to benefit. There have been a number of observational studies run, and these are of course limited due to the fact of the retrospective nature of observational trials. There does seem to be a trend to benefit in at least disease control, potentially overall survival in patients who have either a positive margin or node positivity at the time of resection to incorporate radiation as part of the adjuvant protocol. Whether this radiation should be given concurrently with chemotherapy or this radiation should be following an adjuvant chemotherapy protocol remains up for debate. With the radical differences in overall outcomes between the intestinal subtype and the pancreatic biliary subtype, there certainly does seem to be an argument to begin to think of these as separate diseases and potentially approach the intestinal subtype more like a small bowel or duodenal cancer, in which case we would consider things like adjuvant FOLFOX or CAPOX as part of our post-surgical management. Whereas with the pancreatic biliary cancers, adjuvant systemic therapy such as modified FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel may be more applicable. Of course, in the absence of well-designed clinical trials, this remains more of an expert opinion rather than a standard of care. In metastatic disease, these principles carry over, where we would ideally try to identify where this origin was, whether this appears to be more of an intestinal subtype, which we would treat like metastatic small bowel cancer, or pancreatic biliary subtype, where we would approach either with metastatic management, such as would be used in cholangiocarcinoma with gemcitabine, cisplatin, or a pancreatic cancer approach, such as modified FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine Abraxane. I'll leave off at that. I hope this was a helpful overview. Found this to be interesting to read through. There really isn't a whole lot of discussion around these cancers in many of the guidelines, such as ESMO or ASCO, which many of our treatment approaches are based upon. The NCCN actually has a very well written out summary on the approach to these cancers, which is helpful. It is noteworthy that the recommendations differ from up to date and differ from some other expert guideline reports have been published over the past 10 years. So certainly a thing that you'll see approached differently depending on where you work, and certainly worthwhile to reach out to providers at your center who may have treated these in the past to see what their experience has been and outcomes in their patients. Thanks for listening, and we'll hopefully be back soon to discuss the approach to localized muscle invasive bladder cancer. Bye for now.
For more information, follow us on Twitter at TalkingTumors, or feel free to email us at talkingabouttumors@gmail.com.
Please rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it.
And special shout out to our friend John Kim for all of his musical talents.
And he is the composer of the music that you're hearing right now. Talking About Tumors is not medical advice.
For medical advice, please contact your own healthcare provider.
Opinions stated on this podcast are by the Ryan who said it and no one else. We have no financial disclosures, and this is done purely on our own time to the sake of our enjoyment of the field of medical oncology. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.